The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're coming to you live from our headquarters campus here in Edmond, Oklahoma. Well, Britain has a new prime minister. We'll be getting into that later on in this segment. We've been talking about it for some time. But now it's official. You've got Boris Johnson at the helm, and President Trump had some nice things to say about him yesterday. And as you'll hear later on in this segment, Johnson himself speaking very optimistically about Britain's future. So we'll come to that in just a bit. Here at the camp, PYC, we're winding it down. Just a few days left. Last night, we enjoyed, my wife and I enjoyed the etiquette night with, I think it was four dorms, and a really enjoyable evening, an exquisite meal, of course, together with a lively topic session. I tried to encourage some of the fellows during their leadership class to really take the lead and to take the lead in conversation even, and many of them did that last night, so that was good to see. If we have, speaking of leadership, if we have time later on today's show, we'll summarize some of the content from yesterday's lecture to all of the boys, the young men at this camp. Quick update on the New York PAC and all of the follow-up Bible studies. We've, I think, updated you along the way of the numbers there, the tremendous turnout that we've had. 39 people came along for the second follow-up Bible study. I think the first one, it was something like 55. And so then 39 for the second one, and there's quite a lot of interest for another one. So we'll wait and see as to whether we plan another, but we're informed that there's already a handful of people that are either already attending with the Philadelphia Church of God or are very close. So that's some exciting news coming from the Northeast. Well, today's the big Mueller hearing, a rehash of, I guess, of what he put in his report. It's going to go on, evidently, for 5 hours. Reuters says, drama in Washington as Mueller to testify. Stakes high for Trump and for the Democrats. That's the headline. And he's getting up there, I guess, to go through what he covered in his report months ago. And the Democrats, they want so badly for that report to say something that it does not, if you recall. Well, even some have said that just the reading of it or reminding people of what's in it, those who haven't read it, of course, most in America have not read the report. And so the Democrats are just desperate. They're desperate. They believe that there's evidence in this report that the president obstructed justice, even though there's no underlying crime. We now know that. But they believe in it. If you go back, what was it? There was a weekend where celebrities read through it. I think there was a weekend where Democrats themselves got up on the floor of the House and just read through the report. And so now here comes Mueller, and he can't say anything outside the parameters of the report. And so I guess it's just another rehash. This is from a few days ago. The House Judiciary Committee chairman said Sunday that this week's hearing with Robert Mueller will air very substantial evidence of wrongdoing by President Donald Trump. That's coming from Gerald Nadler from New York. Very substantial evidence. So they're still counting on this to trigger impeachment hearings or whatever else. We'll see. Well, it wasn't on the air yesterday, but the news from Monday about this budget monstrosity. Just need to say a few words about that, because as we've noted before, it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on. It's all about spending trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars The White House, President Trump's White House, reached a deal with Democrats on Monday evening to increase federal spending, to raise the government's borrowing limit. And they here is a bipartisan compromise. As much as they hate each other, they can generally agree on the fact that we need to spend more money. This is from the AP, I believe. The deal for more than $2.7 trillion in spending over 2 years, which must still pass both chambers of Congress and needs President Trump's signature, would suspend the debt ceiling until the end of July 2021. It also raises spending by nearly $50 billion next fiscal year above current levels. It says the agreement foregoes the steep spending cuts initially sought by the administration, providing for about $320 billion in spending over the 2 years above limits set in a 2011 budget law that established automatic spending cuts known as the sequester. So they've found a way around it, these automatic cuts. They want to spend more money. They want to get rid of the debt limit so that they can just continue on. $320 billion it boosts spending. If you remember, not too long ago, when President Trump reluctantly signed a budget that allowed for him to increase defense spending, he said after that this was never going to happen again. He was never going to do this again. Here's CNBC announcing this budget deal just the other day, clip one.
Conservatives are not happy. This deal doesn't include any major spending cuts. Instead, there are about $75 billion in offsets through accounting changes. The Republican Study Committee Chairman Mike Johnson told Trump this weekend that he's disappointed. The Club for Growth said the deal would bankrupt America. And Congressman Mark Walker tweeted this. Yes, that is the Joker. He's standing next to a fire with the words budget deal. So, guys, we will see whether that type of blowback will change the president's mind. The House is planning to vote on the deal this week.
So we'll see how this flies through Congress. It probably will get through. Generally, as I say, they do. Maya McGinnis, she's the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. She was on, I think this was on NBC. I can't remember which. I didn't jot it down. But this is what she had to say about the budget deal. Clip two.
What's missing from the deal was a plan to pay for it. So, ironically enough, we're actually lifting the debt ceiling at the same time that we will make the debt much, much worse.
Lifting the debt ceiling so that we can basically charge more money onto the credit card or make more purchases on the national credit card, she went on to say in clip three.
The problem is that in this period of growth, this White House and Congress have overseen this massive increase of the budget deficit to the point where when we go into the next downturn, we will be much weaker positioned to deal with it. We will actually have a debt relative to the economy that will be twice as high as it was when we went into the last recession. So fiscal stewardship actually has to do with your ability to respond to emergencies, crises, economic downturns. And by borrowing, going on this borrowing binge, we're really weakening ourselves both economically and in terms of global security by having a debt that is slowly moving towards unprecedented territories.
I see on our monitor there, that's actually from CBS, Maya McGinnis. One final thought from her, clip four.
Right now, we're kind of in a bipartisan fiscal free-for-all at the moment where nobody wants to pay for everything. We're putting everything on the national credit card, and that is really dangerous stewardship for the country because you just cannot borrow your way to prosperity. It leaves us in a very weakened state to have debt levels that are so high.
Sounds very similar to some Trumpet articles from over the years. Borrowing our way to prosperity. I think Joe Biden years ago said something very similar to that. Of course, Donald Trump has bragged about being the king of debt. So there's lots of people that really do believe that. That we can just borrow and borrow and borrow and be prosperous. This is from a Republican from Louisiana. He said, no new controls are put in place to constrain runaway spending, and a two-year suspension on the debt limit simply adds fuel to the fire. It says, with more than $22 trillion in debt, we simply cannot afford deals like this one. And that's quite the understatement. AFP said the deal assures that Washington remains on a borrowing binge, a significant setback for the White House's stated goal of reining in expenditures. Now, what's so dangerous about this is, as you hear from the Trump administration, the economy is booming. The U.S. economy, in many other ways, aside from debt, it's doing well. So, as some analysts have pointed out, what happens when there's a downturn? If you can't confront the debt crisis when the economy is doing well, what does it say about what's coming? It says in the Wall Street Journal, fiscal hawks panned reports of the proposed deal Monday before many of the details had been released, warning that it could add trillions of dollars more to projected government debt levels over the next decade. Trillions more. We've forgotten, our people, we've forgotten that all of our national prosperity and wealth, it came upon us because of the blessings that God promised to descendants of Abraham. And you can look back at the long history of the United States, and, well, you can add Britain to the mix as well. It wasn't that long ago that we were lending money to the rest of the world. Now we're the leading borrower. And you look into some of these prophecies in Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28, where it says if we disobey God, we're going to be indebted to others. They're going to lend to us and then hold it against us. Robert Morley wrote back in 2017 that even though President Trump has been a positive force in many ways, a disruptive figure in Washington for sure, but one thing that he's not disrupting at all is the wild, out-of-control spending that we've come to expect from Washington, D.C. Robert said, if there is one thing America has proven in recent history, it is that it knows how to underestimate spending. We really know how to spend. We say $50 trillion, or it's going to be more. Add $50 billion here, it's going to be $75 billion. There's an addiction in Washington, an addiction to debt. And it's intensifying. Again, the king of debt, this article from the Trumpa just a year or two ago. In that article, we said, when it's politically expedient, Democrats will condemn runaway spending. But when it comes to their programs, they always want to spend more. Sadly, the same can be said of Republicans. It's just whoever's in office, the other side's going to use it as a club. Even as they both, as I say, they both agree on, well, at least if you get your spending, then we get ours. That's the way it works. It says both parties claim they want to be fiscally responsible, but both keep spending and adding more debt. Where is it leading? Niall Ferguson. He's warned that empires fall when the interest on their debt equals what they spend on defense. And there's a few others that have issued similar warnings, but not nearly enough. Not nearly enough. This is from one of our articles. Mr. Armstrong believed that a worldwide financial crisis would accelerate many dire end time prophecies. He wrote that a major banking crisis in America could suddenly result in triggering European nations to unite as a new world power. So we watch the economy, we look at these debt figures, these astronomical debt figures, and we see an administration that loves debt. A disruptive figure, yes, but he loves debt. He said that back in the campaign, May of 2016, and that's what's going to trigger that final union, that coming together of those 10 kings in Revelation 17:12. Well, Britain, switching gears here, Britain has their new prime minister. Boris Johnson was announced as the winner of Britain's leadership election yesterday. He took in 66% of the vote compared to 34% for his rival Jeremy Hunt. And so today, Boris Johnson officially becomes prime minister of Great Britain. He'll be announcing his cabinet, those that will be working alongside of him. Here's MSNBC yesterday announcing or summarizing the career of Boris Johnson, clip 9.
Let's interrupt right here. Yeah, Boris Johnson has just been elected the next British prime minister. As you heard before, Boris Johnson was born in New York City to wealthy British parents. He was educated at Eton and Oxford, was elected president of the Oxford Union in 86, began his journalism career at the Times, was fired for falsifying a quote, then worked at the Daily Telegraph, became a member of Parliament, the mayor of London, and now he is Great Britain's prime minister.
Now he's Great Britain's prime minister. There's a kind of a humorous montage. I didn't bring it with me, but all the statements over the years of Boris Johnson saying that he absolutely would not be prime minister. There's no way he would ever be elected. There's no way the people would ever bring him in. And now he's in office. And right away, as soon as the results were announced, Mr. Johnson started off with this very optimistic, energetic look ahead for Great Britain. These are a few clips from his victory speech yesterday. We'll start with clip 7.
I read in my Financial Times this morning that there are no incoming leader. No incoming leader has ever faced such a daunting set of circumstances, it said. Well, I look at you this morning and I ask myself, do you look daunted? Do you feel daunted? I don't think you look remotely daunted to me. And I think that we know that we can do it and that the people of this country are trusting in us to do it, and we know that we will do it.
Well, there have been a lot of earth-shaking developments in Britain, in Europe. He doesn't seem too concerned about it there. At least it's a positive message. I think Richard, coming from Britain, our news gatherer in at Edstone, he felt like it was at least refreshing to hear a British leader say that, well, yes, we can do this. We can break free from Europe. We can go it alone. We're Great Britain. Look, we'll deliver on Brexit. We'll bring the country together. We can defeat Jeremy Corbyn. This is the message coming from the Johnson camp. Here's a bit more from yesterday's victory speech, clip 5.
And we know the mantra of the campaign that has just gone by. In case you've forgotten it, you probably have. It is deliver Brexit, unite the country, and defeat Jeremy Corbyn. And that is what we're going to do. We're going to defeat Jeremy Corbyn. I know some wag was already pointed out that deliver, unite, and defeat was not the perfect acronym for an election campaign, since unfortunately it spells dud. But they forgot the final E, my friends. E for energize. And I say to all the doubters, dude, we are going to energize the country. We're going to get Brexit done on October the 31st. We're going to take advantage of all the opportunities that it will bring in a new spirit of can-do.
That's Boris Johnson yesterday having a little bit of fun with his critics, criticizing the acronym DUD, adding an E to it. Dude, we're going to get this done, he says. We're going to energize the country. We can do this. We're a great nation. Forget about all this doom and gloom that you hear about everywhere. We leave the European Union and everything falls apart. This is what the British people have been hearing over the last couple of years. But he's coming in with a new approach. It's not going to be disastrous for us to leave. We've got 100 days. October 31st is the deadline. We'll make a clean break if we have to. Here's one final clip from his victory speech yesterday, clip six.
And we are once again going to believe in ourselves and what we can achieve. And like some slumbering giant, we are going to rise and ping off the guy ropes of self-doubt and negativity with better education, better infrastructure, more police, fantastic full fiber broadband sprouting in every household. We are going to unite this amazing country and we are going to take it forward. I thank you all very much for the incredible honor that you have just done me. I will work flat out from now on with my team that I will build, I hope, in the next few days.
That's Boris Johnson yesterday promising to make Britain great again. He's pretty much single-mindedly focusing on Brexit, at least for the next 100 days. His aides are saying that he's not going to be taking any vacation time until Brexit is done. He's also said, or his administration has said, that they're not going to be looking into making any new domestic laws for the next 100 days. Again, the focus here is on Brexit, getting out. And of course, we know this is prophesied. We know Herbert Armstrong was talking about this back in the 1950s. Britain will be no part of it. He reiterated it over and again, even in Mystery of the Ages, there at the last. It's fascinating to watch. We've talked before about the parallels between Mr. Johnson and President Trump. President Trump, by the way, was one of the first world leaders to congratulate Boris Johnson following his victory speech. President Trump, by the way, gave a speech last night in which he talked briefly about Britain's new prime minister. Here's what President Trump had to say, clip eight.
We have a really good man is going to be the prime minister of the UK now, Boris Johnson. Good man. He's tough and he's smart. They're saying Britain Trump. They call him Britain Trump. And people are saying that's a good thing. That they like me over there. That's what they wanted. That's what they need. That's what they need. He'll get it done. Boris is good. He's going to do a good job.
That's President Trump last night reacting to Boris Johnson being elected as the new prime minister of Britain. And it looks like the strategy for the UK from the start is going to be to reach across the Atlantic to the United States, to the Trump administration. There are reports that the British embassy in the U.S. is already getting ready for Mr. Johnson to travel to America, maybe in sometime in August. The Telegraph reports that Mr. Johnson aims to spend quality time with the president. One person told the Telegraph that Mr. Johnson is all but certain to go to the U.S. because he needs to meet Donald Trump. And if you look at the next 100 days, besides this scheduled trip to visit with the president, you've also got the G7 meeting in France where he would be able to talk to Donald Trump. And then I think Mr. Johnson's also planning to go to the UN General Assembly in New York in September. So quite a lot of time for this special relationship to get stronger, quite a lot of meetings for these two to come together. My father was talking about this new special relationship right after Donald Trump was elected in November 2016. And just think about what's happened here in the last 3 years for the UK and for the United States. That prophecy in Hosea 5, verses 9 through 11, Britain following along after the commandment of Jeroboam. My father was talking about that again back in November 2016. Jeroboam leading the nations, both nations, into idolatry, looking to men to save us. Well, as I say, there are some statements that are refreshing. It's refreshing to hear politicians who are pro-British and pro-American and not just running down our nations and trashing our founding documents. But still, we have to keep our focus on what your Bible prophesies. As my father said back in 2016, people in Britain who have David's throne are going to be, this was before the new throne revelation. It says, people in Britain who have David's throne are going to be led astray by Jeroboam. They're going to be led more deeply into sin. It says, now that the UK has decided to break away from Europe, it will be more desperate to trade with the US. This will probably result in it following Jeroboam's lead into disaster. So here we see Britain turning toward the United States and the Trump administration. And in the short term, it may well lead to a temporary resurgence. But it's not going to lead our nations to greatness, certainly not permanently. As for the short term, though, Ambrose Evans Pritchard, he's at the Telegraph, pointing out how things could turn around under a Johnson administration. It says Brexiteers control the machinery of British government for the first time. They are no longer relegated to Potemkin departments while pro-EU cadres hold real power under the cabinet office. It says parliamentary arithmetic may not have changed, so nothing really has changed in Parliament. But it did not change in May 1940 either, when the House switched from capitulation to defiance over six extraordinary days. He says what has changed is the mood. So you have all the same politicians in Parliament, but there's a new mood, there's a new attitude at 10 Downing Street now. Finally, you have someone who's pro-Brexit. Finally, you have someone who's going to evidently carry out the will of the people. Along the way, we've also had some articles of late about Britain's deep state. The unelected officials who are opposed to Brexit attacking pro-Brexit supporters. Richard, he may talk about this tomorrow. He has the program tomorrow, but they've taken some setbacks, just like the deep state has in the U.S., as they've been exposed. Well, it's interesting to look at all these parallels. The United States and Britain, Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, they're both seen as outsiders, these two. They're both just absolutely despised by the radical left. They both, well, if you read the headlines leading up to their election, the media, they were telling us constantly, there's no way Donald Trump would ever be president. Here's some of the headlines in the UK in recent months and years. Boris Johnson will never be prime minister. Here's why. That's from The Guardian. The game's up. Boris Johnson. No way you can become prime minister. Another one, The New Statesman, says Boris Johnson's resignation is the end of his career. That's referring to when he quit the cabinet last year. They said it was the end of his career, and now he's prime minister. And here at the Mirror, it says, Boris Johnson in Downing Street, 8 reasons why it will never happen. Well, now it happened. The New York Times, writing about this reality, they're not too excited, which is not surprising. It says, yet with Britain in the throes of its biggest political crisis since World War II, it will be surprising if that turns out to be the case this time. Well, just to back up, it referring to Mr. Johnson's election, the Times said that throughout history, chaos has often been a crucible of great leadership. But that's not going to be the case this time. Boris Johnson, New York Times says, is master of political theater, and the quotable quip, he's idolized by rank-and-file Tories, determined to quit the European Union no matter the consequences, yet his record as journalist, legislator, London mayor, and foreign secretary displays far more bluster than achievement and a disdain for hard work, probity, or the truth. So that's the New York Times. No fan of Boris Johnson. The EU newspapers They're not pleased with what's happening in the UK either. And so he's drawing a lot of hate from politicians, from the establishment, from the media. Just yesterday, he's already had five members of Theresa May's cabinet announcing that they're stepping down. So he's not even in office yet, and they're already protesting. So, again, some similarities there between these two leaders in Britain and the United States. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Well, the hearing begins. They're off to an early start in Washington, D.C. Gerald Nadler making his statement now. It'll be interesting to see what Robert Mueller has to say over the next 5 hours, and of course, you can expect a hysterical reaction from the news media, no matter what. Yesterday, in our leadership class for the young men in God's Church, I referred to an article that was sent to me. I forget the website; it's at a blog somewhere. But the piece is titled "The Age of Amnesia," and it's about how that we're forgetting our past. Our identity. This author says we're discarding the knowledge and the insights passed down over millennia and replacing it with politically correct bromides cooked up in the media and the academy. Truth cast to the ground, as the prophet Isaiah said, and this article goes through, it gives a number of examples of this. How Google will manipulate algorithms in order to draw our attention to items coming from the left wing, the radical left wing in some cases. And then there's all the reports, too, of conservative sites that are being punished or in some cases, shut down. There's the news we see in the news, the corporations, big business like Nike, distancing themselves from what they view as offensive historical expressions or symbols like the Betsy Ross flag and such. And then over the last couple of years, protesters out pulling down statues or painting over murals that they don't like or that they're offended by, even if they're pulling down or painting over images of the founders. The founders of the United States. I've mentioned before about the historical sites like Monticello and the tour guides who are there lying about Thomas Jefferson. Just like they lie about our founders in the university classroom. And of course, speaking of the university, we're living in an age where our understanding and love for history is at an all-time low. People aren't even interested in it, not even in the university sphere. So where is this leading? You've heard of the old adage, those who don't learn from history are condemned to repeat it. If we don't learn from it, we'll make the same mistakes again. Hosea 4 and verse 6 says, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I will also reject you, that you shall be no priest to me. Seeing you have forgotten the law of your God, I will also forget your children. It happened in ancient Israel. It's happening in our nations today. God says, if you forget, or if you lack the right knowledge, then that leads to our destruction. My father's often said that what God's given to us is dangerous knowledge. Dangerous because if we don't use it, if we don't hold on to it. Well, Hosea 4:6 is the end result. Verse 7 says, as they were increased, so they sinned against me. Therefore will I change their glory into shame. Before the break, we talked about the new leadership in Great Britain. There was an article in The Economist about the study of history in Britain, how it's on the decline. And this piece starts out by saying, whatever you think about recent events in Britain, you cannot deny that they qualify as historic. We're living in the midst of historic events. It mentions Brexit. Of course, we now have new leadership. The Conservative Party in Britain, it's deeply divided, which could open the way for Jeremy Corbyn. You have the fracturing alliance, the Western alliance, NATO. Britain's reaching out to the United States right now, but look at what Brexit is going to do to Britain's relationship with the continent, with Europe. And speaking of Europe, you've got the resurgence of all of this authoritarian populism. These are earth-shaking developments. But as the article brings out in The Economist, people don't grasp the significance of these historic developments because they're not grounded in history. They don't have anything to compare it to. It says here, yet even as history's chariot thunders at a furious pace, the study of history in British universities is in trouble. It says the subject used to hold a central position in national life. A scholarship to read history at one of the ancient universities was both a rite of passage for established members of the elite and a ticket into the elite for clever provincial boys. This used to be your ticket to the establishment. You had to be a historian. And it says here, this was as it should be. Britain is a small island with a gigantic history. And history connects it with the wisdom of the ages. But something has gone badly wrong of late. Even as history itself has become more dramatic, the study of history has shriveled. Think of the times that we're living in. It's right. History has become more dramatic. even recent history, looking at what's happened in the last 10, 15 years. And even as it becomes more and more dramatic, the interest level in history, it's dwindling. It says at the same time, the historical profession has turned in on itself. Historians spend their lives learning more and more about less and less, producing narrow PhDs and turning them into monographs and academic articles in the hamster wheel pursuit of tenure and promotion. This article talks about the nightmare of hyper-specialization. Historians that are just so narrowly focused on a tiny subject. Again, even there, we're losing perspective. The article says the historians, or rather, and historians increasingly devote themselves to subjects other than great matters of state. The history of the marginal rather than the powerful. The poor rather than the rich. Everyday life rather than parliament. See, even what gets focused on, it's not important, certainly not as important. And of course, the people who pay the heaviest price for this, as the article brings out, are the students and even the general populace. Ignorance sets in. We're all suffering because of it. It says the obvious reason to worry about this is that there is more than a little truth in the old adage that those who don't learn from history are condemned to repeat it. It says the world seems to be determined to copy the mistakes of the 1930s and 40s. How many times have we heard this on this program? We're following along the same course that we were on in the 1930s and 40s. That's from The Economist. The study of history in sharp decline in Britain. And, of course, it's the same here in the United States. In fact, it's a little bit worse. This other article that I mentioned at the top of the segment, The Age of Amnesia, it says that a healthy appreciation for the past is being lost. Today, historical analysis is increasingly shaped by concerns over race, gender, and class. Race, gender, and class. That's the lens through which we view everything. It's like I was saying last week. You can't even pause to celebrate the achievement from 50 years ago, the moon landing, without the New York Times and the Washington Post telling us that, well, actually it was a failure. Actually, it was no great accomplishment. Actually, we were outperformed by the Soviets. It says here, peasants and many nobles in the medieval period usually lacked firsthand knowledge of even the Bible and Christian theology and lore, yet they had the excuse of being illiterate during an age in which books were expensive to produce and rare. Back then, they had a legitimate excuse. We didn't have books everywhere. You couldn't go to a bookshop and buy a used book for just pennies on the dollar. And, of course, education. Well, so many people were illiterate, and they just had to take the Catholic Church's word for it. Now you can study the Bible yourself. You can see what God says in the holy, inspired word that is the Bible. We have all of this, like Solomon said, there's no end to books and knowledge. We're living in the information age. But what do we do with it? This piece says, but now with access to information unimaginable in the past, our knowledge of history is fading. Information is increasingly separated from actual knowledge. Blogs replace books, and tweets replace essays. And then it talks about the ignorance. Just basics from not that long ago that we don't even understand or know about. It mentions that book reading outside of school or outside of the workplace, it's declined significantly. It's not as popular as it used to be. People reading books just for pleasure. There's a small group, a sliver, I guess you could say, because there are still bookshops. There are places like Half Price Books here in Edmond, which seem like they're doing fairly well. Amazon and such online. But it's a smaller audience than it once was, and particularly among the young people, at least as far as serious books are concerned, nonfiction, history. They're just not read. It says here, the spread of mass education may have exemplified the promise of liberal civilization, but without an understanding and appreciation of what allowed it to flourish, it could also accelerate its dissolution. It says here, the reduction and reshaping of the past are essential to undermining liberal democracy. The great exemplars of the past, Washington, Madison, Burke, Jefferson, Lincoln, Churchill, they all warned that human beings are not necessarily good. And for that reason, power must be dispersed and restrained, not concentrated. So here are these great exemplars of the past who understood a bit of truth about human nature. What do we know about human nature? Thanks to the Bible, Jeremiah 17:9, Romans 8:7. A lot of the fellows, they were familiar with those scriptures yesterday in class, which was nice to see. But here we've gotten away from these exemplars of the past, those who believe that because human beings are not necessarily good, power needs to be dispersed. There needs to be a separation of powers in the case of the United States founders. It says here, yet we are witnessing the creation of a society as envisioned by H.G. Wells, controlled by a credentialed elite. This new elite, he predicted, would replace democracy with a higher organism of what he called the New Republic. So you have these elites today. You could call them the deep state, whether in the United States or Britain. And they think they know the way. They want to impose their will on the populace. One final quote here. It says, any reasonable reading of history cautions us against such power grabs, however well-intentioned. But this won't resonate if our next generation remains cut off from the past and molded by a highly manipulated tech-driven reality. It says, if one does not even know about the legacies underpinning democracy, individual freedom, and open discussion, one is not likely to miss them when they've eroded. If you don't know what you're missing, how are you going to stand and protest? We don't know what we're missing because we don't know our history. In the book of Deuteronomy, this is Deuteronomy 4 and verse 9, God said, only take heed to yourself and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, but teach them to your sons and to your sons' sons, to your grandchildren as well. God told the educators in Israel anciently, he said, make sure that you don't forget what you've seen, what you've observed, how this all started. Notice verse 10, it says, specifically the day that you stood before the Eternal your God at Horeb, when the Lord said unto me, gather me, the people together, and I will make them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they should live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children. So here again, God draws attention to the beginning, the small beginning, how it all began. This is your history. This is your identity. Don't forget it. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., he wrote in The Disuniting of America, he said, history is to the nation as memory is to the individual. An individual deprived of memory becomes disoriented and lost, not knowing where he has been or where he is going. So a nation denied a conception of its past will be disabled in dealing with its present and its future. The age of amnesia. We forget. We have forgotten. A couple more verses here before we conclude. I read these to the fellas yesterday. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 12. This is where Paul is encouraging Timothy to set an example for the brethren, to be a good example for God's people. Don't let any man despise your youth. Just set the right pattern in conduct, in your speech, your love, your faith, your purity, all these things. Be you an example. And then in verse 13, he says, until I come, give attendance to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Give attendance to reading. If you look at that word, attendance, in the Greek, it means to give heed or to give attention to reading. The Amplified Bible says to devote yourself to reading. As I was telling the fellows yesterday, you have to give attention to this. You have to. If you're going to be a leader, I told them, this is leadership class. And if you're going to be a leader, you have to read and study. Every great leader in history has done that. This is a point that just keeps jumping off the page of all these books we've been going through in book club. Churchill, Napoleon, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson. All of these examples, all of them voracious readers. They had a hunger, an intense hunger for knowledge and understanding. President Harry Truman, he once said that the only new thing in the world is the history you don't know. In other words, there's nothing new under the sun. And if there's something you don't know, it's because you haven't learned it from history. He too, Harry Truman, was a voracious reader of history. He studied history his whole life and realized that it's essential to the role of a leader. Whether he's a president or a leader of any kind, it is essential. Give attendance to it. Give attention to reading and study. Give heed to reading and studying. Devote yourself to it so that you can be a leader for God. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, and we'll get to some email feedback, hopefully on tomorrow's program, or I guess maybe Friday. But if you'd like to submit some feedback, you can send it to td@kpcg.fm. You can also submit audio feedback at the TDRS page on the trumpet.com website. We'd love to hear back from you. Thank you for joining us on today's program, and we'll see you next time.